Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name's David Clegg, the editor of The Courier, and I come to you from Broughty Ferry, where we're having quite an alarming situation with coronavirus. I'll be joined by journalists from across DC Thompson's newspaper portfolio to discuss that and the other issues of the week in Scottish politics. So I am joined by, from The Courier, our political correspondent, Derek Healy, from The Press and Journal, their political editor, Tom Peterkin, and from The Aberdeen Evening Express, their political reporter, Adele Merson. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
I think the geography of coronavirus in Scotland is quite interesting at the minute. So I think that's because we're kind of spread out across the country. I'm in Broughty Ferry. Derek, you're in Dundee, is that right?
Yep, that's right.
Tom's in Edinburgh, and Adele, you're in Aberdeen. So the Cooper Angus chicken factory, Two Sisters, is at the centre of this outbreak we've had during the week, and it's caused a big problem in Tayside, and the Scottish Government and Nicola Sturgeon are pretty concerned about the rate at which it's spreading. So 900 families connected to that plant were told to self-isolate last night. Meanwhile, Aberdeen remains in lockdown. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy there that some people have picked up on, because the numbers or the statistics seem to suggest that Aberdeen's in not such a bad place. Derek, you've been looking at these new numbers that came out overnight. Can you tell us a little bit about what the picture is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Nicola Sturgeon today was talking about why different tactics are being used in different areas. And I think essentially it comes down to the plan for Cooper Angus and for Tayside more widely, is to target individual households. So as you said, it's 900 employees, which goes up to, I think, about 1,200 in total when you include people who are on short contracts or contracted in. So, I mean, we're talking thousands of people across all these families. But Nicola Sturgeon has stressed the point that only a small number of cases, these new cases that we're seeing, are not linked to the plant. Health officials suggest there's a pretty minimal risk of community transmission, which she wasn't able to say with any kind of confidence in Aberdeen. So that's the reason she's given for the difference in the way these are being handled. But we did see, as you said, as you mentioned, some kind of interesting figures coming out overnight. So the latest Scottish Government modelling report highlighted six local authority areas where the number of cases was higher than expected at this stage of the pandemic. So it found Perth and Kinross has the highest risk of local coronavirus transmission anywhere in Scotland and may require greater vigilance from health officials. So Perth and Kinross, what that means is it's now surged past other areas that are dealing with local outbreaks, including Aberdeen, which obviously was the site of Scotland's first lockdown 2 weeks ago, with this cluster linked to pubs and bars in the city. So the new method that they're using to come up with this information is designed to be more useful than the R number, because this figure can be volatile when the overall number of deaths is low. I think this is probably going to be a way of working out prevalence and issues that we're going to hear quite a lot about in the future, because it does seem to be a little bit more accurate when numbers are lower. So areas above a numerical threshold of six are deemed to be at a higher risk of local transmission. So only Perth and Kinross and Dundee were. So Perth and Kinross had 12.7 and Dundee had 7.7. And of course, both of those are places where the workers of the factory and their families live.
Yeah, makes sense.
So I think it kind of indicates that the risk is still quite high there. So whilst Nicola Sturgeon is saying that these are quite different outbreaks, she's also said that she's keeping her options open in terms of how this is going to be handled. Right now, it is that plan to target individual households, but we could see, I think, further measures going forward as well.
How's that being received in Aberdeen, Adele? Because obviously there was some controversy last week with Aberdeen Council administration not wanting the lockdown to continue, but the Scottish Government insisting it must. Yet we're looking at figures today whereby the Scottish Government's own modelling Tayside is at much more risk of community spread of the virus than Aberdeen is, yet Aberdeen City remains in lockdown and Tayside doesn't. What's the feeling about that up north?
I have noticed a definite kind of shift in the opinions that I'm hearing, just both anecdotally and I guess also from the council leaders. I think the first 2 weeks, people seem to have an understanding of why we had to do this. And just in the last sort of week or few days, I think people have started to feel that some have, you know, said the argument, are we being made an example of? I've seen that kind of mentioned in lots of places. Obviously, you know, as Derek kind of hinted to there, the Aberdeen outbreak's a little bit different in that it was related to just so many sort of city centre venues that's the reason she keeps kind of, the First Minister keeps mentioning. But there's definite anger here, I think, now that there seems to be this disagreement over the fact that the council leaders say the sort of local outbreak incident team had suggested that restrictions could start to lift from tomorrow, this Saturday. And obviously the decision was made to review on Sunday and then to begin to relax restrictions, hopefully from Wednesday. So that's kind of where this argument that's the centre of this argument at the moment.
Okay. What are the councillors saying and what is their explanation for? Because I guess we've discussed on this podcast a lot that the tension has been between keeping the virus at bay and protecting the economy. I suppose there must be a lot of concerned businesses in Aberdeen city centre. Is that what's driving the councillors' position, or is there more politics involved? And what exactly are they saying about it?
Yeah, they've been saying that it will have a significant impact on the local economy. I mean, obviously, we only had about 2 weeks of restrictions, so businesses in the city only had, you know, that long to try and get a bit of business going again. And we've already seen, I'm sure, similar to other places in the country, not distinct to Aberdeen, but we have started to see businesses closing here in the last sort of week or so. And I think people are getting concerned that, you know, Aberdeen has historically had its own problems with the downturn in oil, and that this compounds on top of that could almost be like the perfect storm for places to close. I mean, I don't want to speculate too much, but there have also historically been a sort of a little bit of a battle between Aberdeen City Council and the Scottish Government on many issues in the past. So it doesn't really surprise me that it has come to this. It's a sort of coalition of Conservative and Aberdeen Labour, as I'm sure we'll go on to discuss later on with the chat about Richard Leonard. They've been in a sort of administration, and so they've kind of butted heads with the Scottish Government on several different issues in the past.
Tom, you were covering the briefing. I'm speaking to you, it's about 2:15 on Friday. You were at the briefing this afternoon. You've just came from that. What was the First Minister's state of mind on Aberdeen, did you think? Did she give an indication that the lockdown was coming to an end there, or was she not giving a lot away?
She didn't give a huge amount away, but she did say that the situation was improving, that there was no evidence of the virus or the cluster transmitting to outside the city boundaries to places like Aberdeenshire and Moray. And that's something she said that they were looking at very closely in Aberdeenshire, certainly because of the, you know, that a lot of people in Aberdeenshire commute into the city. And the situation, the lockdown is going to be reviewed on Sunday when we should get some more clarity. But she has said in the past that on from Wednesday, non-alcoholic, non-licensed cafes, they're hoped to open then. And she also dropped a strong hint that they'd be looking at, you know, these large venues like bingo halls, opening them up again. So she was trying to give some suggestion of progress, I suppose.
And Derek, coming back to the Cooper Angus situation, as we've said, we've got 900 households told to self-isolate. We've been covering in the front page of our paper this morning, a warning that everyone needs to be vigilant, that the elderly, those that are shielding, are at particular risk in Tayside at the minute because there is this increased risk of community spread. What steps are open to the First Minister if the numbers don't get better over the weekend? I mean, it seems that while she was resisting a localised lockdown this afternoon, it doesn't strike me that there's a great deal more that can be done other than going to a localised lockdown after that. Is that a fair synopsis?
I think that is fair. I mean, I think one of the difficulties that's going to be there is, I think with Aberdeen, it was a case of the outbreak was in the city, and if you lock down the city, there's hopefully not going to be too much spread out to the surrounding areas, and that we've seen that seems to have been the case. With this one, you've got the cases are obviously to do with the Two Sisters factory in Cooper Angus, but an awful lot of people maybe work there but live in Dundee. It's not far from Dundee at all. They maybe live in Angus. Nicola Sturgeon actually touched on that today. How do you lock down without having to lock down effectively, you know, a huge area of Tayside? I think that would be the difficulty they would face, as it's not the same as the Aberdeen one geographically either. So Nicola Sturgeon says she's going to consider the options and see what else they can do. I think, you know, it could be a case of bringing in some restrictions maybe over the wider area, but I think she'll be keen to avoid bringing in the same level of restrictions that we've seen in Aberdeen if possible.
It was interesting that Nicola Sturgeon sort of described it as, well, in Aberdeen, because the cluster, you know, came from a wide range of bars and pubs and so on. The way that the virus had spread meant that they had to do this local lockdown, which is a measure that has, you know, affected a large population. But the measures aren't as stringent as what they're having to do with a smaller number, you know, very stringent measures that, you know, albeit thousands of people related to the Cooper Angus one, you know, that it's not as many as are affected in Aberdeen by the measures, but the measures themselves are extremely draconian, aren't they, you know, to self-isolate for 14 days.
Yeah, and involving kids and schools and all the rest of it, they're certainly taking it very seriously. Just on a final point on this, Derek, and you may not have an answer to this, is there any more clarity about how this Two Sisters outbreak began? Is there any discussion about how that happened and whether the factory should have been on top of it quicker, or any kind of analysis of that going on at the minute?
Well, I think there was a suggestion that it had been brought in by possibly a manager, and that's how it got into the factory initially, and then started to spread among the staff. It has only spread to a kind of handful of cases in the community of the immediate contacts of the employees. So it has spread mainly in the factories. I think there probably is a question to be asked there. I'm sure the factory owners would dispute that there's anything more they could have done. I think there probably will be questions there in terms of how that's been handled and how it's spread and how long it was spreading for. They took the decision to shut down on Sunday night when these cases were still fairly low. So that would indicate, I think, they have, certainly when there's been a picture there that these have been building up, the decision has been taken pretty quickly to just shut things down.
And it's an illustrative example of just how one case can spread and exponentially increase if you don't get a grip of it very quickly, which I expect is something we'll be seeing more of in the weeks and months ahead. And we will be keeping tabs on here at the Stooshy and in the Courier and the Press and Journal newspapers. I'll move on from that issue, because there's two other issues this week which are non-coronavirus related, which I want to discuss. The first one is the Alex Salmond situation, which feels like it's kind of been on pause. Our listeners will be aware that the former First Minister's trial on various sexual assault offences took place in March, where he was acquitted of all charges and left court without a stain on his character. That happened just as the coronavirus situation was becoming so serious. In fact, the verdict came on the same day that Boris Johnson put the UK into lockdown. And after that trial, Mr. Salmond said that he had more to say on this, but that he would be keeping it until after the coronavirus crisis had been dealt with. But we have seen movement on it now, although the coronavirus crisis is not yet over by a long shot. The Scottish Parliament's parliamentary inquiry is up and running into the original handling by the Scottish Government of the sexual harassment complaints against the former First Minister, and the BBC also aired a documentary on the case this week, which has caused quite a bit of controversy. So I'd just like to briefly talk about those two issues and maybe have a think about what's going to happen next with the Alex Salmond situation. First of all, Tom, you were covering the parliamentary inquiry, which took its first evidence session this week from the permanent secretary of the Scottish Government, the highest civil servant in Scotland, Leslie Evans. She was the person who was in charge of that that failure or that botched sexual harassment inquiry into the original complaints against Alex Salmond. He has been very critical of her. Many of his allies have said she should resign over this inquiry, which the court found had been tainted by apparent bias. So MSPs are trying to get to the bottom of what went wrong. Did we learn anything from Leslie Evans' evidence to the committee, do you think?
Yes, I think we did. It was a sort of eagerly anticipated. You know, it's very rare that perhaps you see the permanent secretary or, you know, being questioned on such a matter. And one of the main things that came out of it was that we discovered that Leslie Evans told Nicola Sturgeon or suggested that there were concerns about Alex Salmond's inappropriate behaviour back in November 2017. Now, the significance of that is that the formal inquiry into claims made by two females about Alex Salmond wasn't launched until the following year in January. And one of the key things about this inquiry is what did Nicola Sturgeon know and when did she know it? And previously we've heard from Nicola Sturgeon that she's told Holyrood that she was first made aware of actual complaints made against Alex Salmond on April the 2nd, 2018. So there was some interesting detail on the timeline there. There was also a sort of moment of sort of quite a theatrical moment when Leslie Evans was asked by Murdo Fraser if she had known that there was advice issued that female civil servants should not work alone with the former First Minister. And her reaction was to say, I can't comment on that, which was then backed up by the committee convener, Linda Fabiani of the SNP, who said that the question was out with the remit of the committee, which in turn sparked a huge reaction. You know, why should the permanent secretary of not be able to answer what seems a question that seems to really be at the heart of this whole inquiry. So that generated a big row as well. And then there was some very some interesting line of questioning taken by Alex Cole-Hamilton of the Lib Dems, who, you know, basically asked Leslie Evans, a big part of the inquiry is that there were in late 2017 the Scottish Government began to draw up a new process for dealing with harassment claims, and a lot of Alex Salmond's allies are very concerned because it not only did it include current ministers but included former ministers. So Alex Cole-Hamilton suggested to Leslie Evans that, you know, was this new anti-harassment policy designed, in his words, to get Alex Salmond? Now, Leslie Evans replied, said, no, absolutely not. But anyway, that was a sort of exchange that gave one some sort of insight into some of the issues at stake.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because in my mind, there's three elements to the Alex Salmond situation. There's the allegations and question over his conduct while in office. And it's been tested in court and found that he didn't commit any criminal behaviour towards women while in office. But there's still, I think, a lingering question about whether some of his behaviour was appropriate. I think it would be fair to say. There's a second issue, which is about how Nicola Sturgeon, as the current First Minister, dealt with these concerns or interjected or intervened or interplayed with these concerns whenever they were highlighted to her. And there's a third issue about whether there's some kind of political conspiracy against Alex Salmond about whether the court case that we saw and the allegations that we've seen were a fit up, as I believe Kenny McCaskill, the former Justice Secretary and ally of Mr. Salmond, put it during the week. So you have those three elements, and there's a tension in that committee that we saw, because the committee's only remit is to discover what went wrong with the government's process. Alex Salmond's behaviour is not on trial by that committee. That committee has no remit to investigate how Alex Salmond behaved in office. Their only remit is to discover the culture and working practices that led to that Scottish government inquiry and how they botched it so badly. And they also don't, that now the third section about whether there was a conspiracy about Alex Salmond may come into that. So when you saw the question about whether there was any policy in place to stop lone female civil servants working with Alex Salmond, I guess that is why the committee convener suggested that wasn't an appropriate forum for that. But as a member of the general public and as other MSPs concerned, there's kind of the question, well, you know, if that was a policy, which we heard in court that it was, where is the appropriate forum to get to the bottom of that type of question? And I think we actually saw that tension between those three things play out on the documentary, which the BBC aired during the week as well. So it was a documentary presented by Kirsty Walk, one of Scotland's most experienced and well-respected broadcasters. But it's been pretty heavily criticised. Derek, did you see that documentary and what were your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I watched it. I thought it was a pretty strange documentary in some ways. I think obviously with the outcome of the trial and the fact that there's still questions hanging over things, maybe they were limited in terms of what they could do. I think going back to that point of having, you know, these three points of the Alex Salmond situation, it does feel as if, I mean, I wonder if we're ever going to get kind of all of the answers that we would want. I think one of the things that was quite disturbing coming out of the documentary was the level of abuse that was kind of levelled at some of the journalists involved, particularly some of the female journalists. And I know they've kind of hit out at some of that on social media, I think, particularly when the subject matter is what it is. It is quite kind of disturbing to see that. I think there's obviously legitimate criticisms to be levelled at any kind of piece of journalism or any piece of work. And I think in particular, you know, there's obviously only so much you can go over in terms of a court trial. There's been an outcome to that trial and it was ruled in a certain way. So to kind of go back over things again, I think, is always quite difficult. Perhaps there could have been more of a kind of focus on some of that, for want of a bit, kind of better words, conspiracy theory element to what had gone on behind the scenes, a bit more investigation there, or even kind of what actions were taken by the government when this was all coming to light. I thought there was a bit thin on the ground in some of that stuff. And there was quite a lot in terms of kind of custody work, attending the trial and standing outside and having a chat. There wasn't so much of that other side of things. I think maybe that would have helped.
Alex Bell, who's a columnist for The Courier and The Press and Journal, he appears every Thursday if you're interested, so find him in print or online. But he was obviously a defence witness in the trial, and he had worked as Alex Salmond's head of policy. And he wrote his column this week on the documentary, and I thought he made some very legitimate points. And what he was saying is that part of the problem was this was a failure of journalism, because there's no new facts in it whatsoever. What we got was a rehash of the evidence in the trial, but it was largely, as Alex Salmond's allies have pointed out, with some credibility, I think it was largely just the prosecution case. There wasn't a great deal of time given over to the defence case, so I'm not sure that you could say that it was a fair reflection of what happened in court. It wasn't a balanced court report, but of course a documentary doesn't have to be. But it then spoke to some of Alex Salmond's allies, Kenny McCaskill, as I've mentioned before, and also Jim Sillars, the former deputy leader of the SNP, who both seem to have bought into the conspiracy theory, but it didn't tell us any more about the conspiracy theory. It's still this quite vague, blurry, just, oh, there's something going on in the background, but we're not quite sure what it was. So it didn't pin that down either. And I just felt that we didn't really get anywhere with it. It didn't take us any further forward. And after watching it, I was kind of feeling, well, I'm not really sure that was an hour of television that really took us any further forward. Adele, how did you find it?
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And I thought it was well put together from a sort of artistic sense, I guess. It was a little bit style over substance. I didn't come away from it having felt that I had learned anything new. It just lacked a little bit of, it would have been, there were certain threads came out, you know, that you'd like to have pulled and just examined a little bit more, like, as you say, potentially in and around the conspiracy theories and also, I guess, around the problems with reporting around sexual assault as well. I would have been quite interested in examining that.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing we did, because that it failed to do, and I thought it might have been something that would look at would be, you know, the challenges and difficulties of prosecuting a sexual assault case, any sexual assault case, not even necessarily one involving such a high profile figure, but it didn't really do that either.
It just didn't examine that kind of thing. But I mean, I think Derek's touched on it, but I did find the sort of abuse online is, I guess, as the women on the podcast here, depressing to the extreme. I think you can, you know, legitimately criticize a documentary without calling people, you know, witches and sort of words that are related to their gender. That I found all that didn't paint people in the best light, really.
Sorry, you may hear some background noise from my children who have a friend over to play and are quite excited about it. We thought we should let that happen, as Tayside could be locked down and we may not be allowed to have it next week. But if there is any background noise, that is what you're hearing. Tom, just before we move on from Alex Salmond, given the discussion there, and I think that is true. What Adele's point about that, not exploring that properly, and also the issue about, you know, the abuse of any journalist, especially a female journalist who tries to get involved in these issues. And also it's a very challenging legal climate for obvious reasons to try and dig in around and about these stories. What's your thoughts on if we'll ever really know exactly what went on and where the truth of this matter lies? Because it is pretty important. We have on one hand allegations that the former First Minister was harassing women while in office. Now, it's been found in court that he didn't commit any crime, but I think there is still some question marks over some of his behaviour while in office. And on the other hand, we have a former Justice Secretary explicitly stating that, you know, allegations of sexual assault against the former First Minister were fictionalised in a political plot to destroy him, which would be an incredible state of affairs if that was true.
Yeah, I mean, the various claims are sensational, and yeah, that the challenge is getting to the truth. So that's why I think there's a big onus on the MSPs on this committee, you know, as far as the remit of the committee allows them to try and you know, find out as much as possible about what is a very, I mean, I know the remit is limited to how the Scottish government handled the original claims, but I think there's a big responsibility on the committee to find out as much as it can, and, you know, a big responsibility on journalists like us as well. Because it is one of these things, you know, it's one person, you know, various claims. There are all sorts of conspiracies that you can make to fit various things that have happened. Yeah, so it's a very blurry situation, I would say, but one that is very important that we find out as much as we can.
Yeah, I think it's certainly something that merits more investigation. We'll move on now, though, and I just want to briefly touch before we finish for this week to Richard Leonard, who some of you may know, probably not that many of you. He is the Scottish Labour leader, but he has, my five-year-old now has a higher public profile than him since he jumped into the background of this podcast. Adele, you've been at Mr. Leonard's briefing today for Scottish journalists. He's trying to reboot his leadership of the Scottish Labour Party. There's been calls for him to resign. We've heard that Keir Starmer, the UK Labour leader, is not happy with him. The poll ratings are absolutely dire. There's not really any silver linings as far as I can see. How was his mood? What was he saying?
Yeah, so he was he gave his keynote speech, as he called it today, via YouTube, and there was a strong focus on the sort of care home, the problems related to COVID-19 and patients being transferred, positive patients being transferred into care homes. That formed quite a central part of his speech. He's obviously in First Minister's Questions. He routinely, that's always kind of his point of attack, is always in that area. It's quite interesting. He said that that if necessary, people. Those affected, if necessary, the patients must face justice, if necessary, in a court of law. So quite a lot of the journalists were asking him about that, you know, as to could this see clinicians, could this see government officials, in his opinion, prosecuted for their role in that? And he said that in some cases that might rest at the level of the care homes, but in other cases may point to a higher level. He said, like, looking at international examples, there's a number of class actions being entered sort of across the world, which have led to a number of respondents being named, including care home providers, but also governments. So that was quite an interesting part. Other than that, there was a lot of announcements for various policies, but they were sort of ones we already know about, like building thousands of council homes, Scottish Jobs Guarantee Scheme, the establishment of the National Care Service. It was lacking in sort of, there wasn't very much new in terms of the announcements, I felt.
I suspect he's going to struggle to grab the news agenda with it today, given everything else that's going on. Would that be a fair synopsis?
Yes, I'd agree with that. I mean, there was some discussion about the recent growing support for independence in the polls, and he put this down to the conduct of Boris Johnson, and he said there'd been, it was also coupled with an incredible amount of media exposure to the SNP, so sort of going along the lines of the Scottish Conservatives attack line that Nicola Sturgeon is getting too much media attention through her daily COVID-19 briefings. But I guess a number of the journalists said, are you really putting the sovereign independence purely down to that rather than also your own failings? So it seemed maybe perhaps lacked a little bit of sort of insight as to how his own party's contributing to that situation as well.
Okay. Derek, there's always challenges in the Labour Party. But, you know, in fairness to Richard Leonard, those are all important issues. You know, he's talking about the care home crisis during COVID, which is, you know, there could hardly be a more important issue right now. He's talking about housing and jobs and education, which are always an important issue, but he just can't cut through with the public. Is it the message? Is it the messenger? Or is it everything?
I think it's really difficult. I mean, this is, what is he now, 3 years into the job? He said recently that he's kind of elected to fight this election and to try and get some good results. I mean, it looks challenging at the moment.
You're king of understatement, Derek.
Yeah, but it does look challenging. I think we've heard that, you know, that people high up in the UK party kind of privately acknowledging that there's a problem in Scotland, and I think there's concerns about what the outcome is going to be. I think it's difficult to touch on, because a lot of the policies, some of them have been popular and have been well received. I think when you're as far into a leadership as Richard Leonard currently is, and so many members of the public don't know who you are, I think that's a really, really difficult position to try and climb back from. I mean, even kind of touching on today, these policy announcements coming through, how much traction are any of them going to have if the public don't know who you are and don't really kind of know the things you're standing for? So I think that's just tricky, that position.
Yeah, it certainly is. Tom, I'll maybe finish with you on Richard Leonard. When I was on the Daily Politics beat, I got a lot of complaints from Labour figures that I was too hard on Richard Leonard. So I will not put my own opinion across. I will just ask you one final question. You've been covering the politics beat in Scotland for a long time. Do you think that Richard Leonard is the worst leader any major political party in Scotland has had since devolution?
Oh, that's a long list, isn't it?
Or can you name a worse one?
Oh God, he'll never forgive me. Henry McLeish wasn't brilliant.
He was First Minister, I suppose, which is an achievement in a way.
He was, yeah. So I suppose he was successful in that regard. Yeah.
Okay, I've put you unfairly on the spot here, Tom. I tell you what, we'll come back to you next week. We'll give you a week to think of someone who's worse than Richard Leonard. There's a challenge. And on that note, we'll leave it for this week. So I'd like to thank Adele, Derek and Tom for taking part. I'd like to thank Chris for producing. I'd like to apologise to Richard Leonard and all who sail in the good ship Scottish Labour.
And Henry McLeish.
And I'd like to thank you for listening. For the Stooshy, I've been David Clegg. Cheers.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.